from Mississippi to Idaho, Nebraska to Hawaii, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, as we observe President's Day, it is an appropriate time to discuss presidential greatness. We are joined by Amity Schles from the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation. Bitcoin started out as a fringe currency, but it has gone mainstream with major investments by Tesla and other big-name companies. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Both President Joe Biden and U.S. Senator Mitt Romney have so-called child allowance plans to put more money into the hands of parents. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a look at the proposals. And the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump is underway. It is more political theater than actual impeachment. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President's Day is a time to honor our past chief executives and weigh presidential greatness. But one holder of that office thought a president should never think of himself as being great. Amity Schles is co-editor of the autobiography of Calvin Coolidge, and she serves as chairman of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation. She is here to talk about presidential greatness. Amity, welcome to American Radio Journal. Amity, you are a biographer of Calvin Coolidge. He talked a bit about presidential greatness, the greatness of presidential programs. What was President Coolidge's view of the term great?
President Coolidge thought great was dangerous, and you oughtn't to use that adjective to describe your goals or to somehow for it to slip into some description of yourself as the president. I'm going to paraphrase here. Coolidge said it was a good thing for the country if the president wasn't a great man. It was a safety. Don't be a great man. The president is just an office. The presidency is what you serve. The state is not you. We're not French emperors.
At various times, presidents have used the word great to describe some of their programs. And in the op-ed that you wrote recently, you talked a lot about Lyndon Johnson and the so-called Great Society. How did the word great raise expectations for that program that ultimately have never been met?
Well, Johnson could have called his program of the 1960s, on which so much is being built up now, the Good Society. He didn't. He called it the Great Society because he was a political animal and because that was inspiring. But the problem lies in the delivery. Johnson promised as part of the Great Society to cure, C-U-R-E, poverty. He didn't say alleviate or reduce. He said cure. He promised to increase racial harmony through specific race-related policy. The policy that he put forward that became law actually divided races in the United States, as we can see today. We don't have more harmony after a few trillion in spending on racial harmony. He promised to improve education by standardized tests. Our children read less well than they used to, the average. So the problem with grade is you can't often deliver on it. That's a human story. And Coolidge is the opposite example. Would you like to talk about that?
I would like to talk about that. Calvin Coolidge, probably the most self-effacing president ever. Silent Cal was his nickname. So how did he approach this whole issue of greatness then?
Well, Coolidge didn't have no ego. Nobody who gets to the presidency has no ego. What he had was the discipline to subordinate his ego, and that's the test. He had a president before him, Warren Harding, who had good policies, let's not say great, to reduce government intrusion in the economy. Harding, however, was a slob, as Alice Roosevelt Longworth said. That is, he thought more about himself from time to time and didn't complete projects and had dicey friends. That's how we got the scandal Teapot Dome, which you'll remember from the history book. So Harding passed away. His vice president, the prim, prissy Calvin Coolidge of New England, suddenly becomes president. And what did Coolidge do? He said, we, the Republican Party, agreed on a few goals back in 1920. They're right there in the platform. The burden of taxation is staggering and must be reduced. I exist only insofar as I work to fulfill the commitments of that platform. The tax rate was over 50%. Harding got it down a little through incredible energy because Congress was not always with Coolidge. Republican Party itself was divided there sharply. Many Republicans were going progressive and founding a new party, the Progressive Party. Coolidge poured tremendous energy into further reducing tax rates. So he got the top rate of the income tax down to 25. That's even lower than Ronald Reagan's big achievement. And he did it through personal discipline and subordination. Why do we care what a president does in the White House? Because you don't want him to waste political capital with scandal. So Coolidge was downright ascetic in the White House. He actually even fired the White House housekeeper because she spent too much and he was cutting budgets. So if he asked the country to cut the federal budget and to do without, then he must also do without in the White House. That wasn't always pleasant for the Coolidge children or Mrs. Coolidge. He asked for a simple inaugural when he did have one. But the policies Coolidge worked on worked for the United States. And so Coolidge became popular without claiming greatness. And I often take school children to President Coolidge's grave. I hope you visit it when the world opens up, because his grave is not huge. It's just one in a line with his family. You kind of have to look hard for the presidential seal. It's not a mausoleum. It's not an edifice like Harding's grave, which Coolidge, of course, saw and honored. And the school children nowadays are like, what? Wait, this can't be the presidential grave. It's too small. But he said a president should return to the people. He was like George Washington, whom he studied, in that he believed also in a turnover in the president. So the greatest example of Coolidge's great humility was that he chose not to run again in 28 when he surely could have won. He'd won only one election. We didn't have some of the laws we have now. He had been in the presidency more than one term because he had the little rump of the presidency from Harding. But he was entitled to run for president in 28 by our culture more than, and what's more, the Republican Party insisted Coolidge run again because he was darn popular. But he ignored his own party. He said it's better to change the person in office from time to time. That's another example. He didn't change the rules to suit himself.
We have been talking with Amity Schles, who is a Coolidge biographer and co-editor of the newly republished autobiography of Calvin Coolidge. She also is chairman of the board of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation. So, Amity, tell us a bit about the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, how folks can learn more about Calvin Coolidge, and also find your books.
The Calvin Coolidge Foundation seeks to introduce young people to Calvin Coolidge because they don't really learn about him in school. Unfortunately, he's kind of a footnote, right? Or a seat warmer in between more flamboyant presidents.
And Amity, what website can folks go to learn more about the foundation?
CoolidgeFoundation.org.
CoolidgeFoundation.org. We have been talking with Amity Schles, who is the chairman of the board of directors of the Coolidge Foundation, also a Coolidge biographer. Amity, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on Capitol Hill. Of course, the big story of the week, impeachment. Scott, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you, Loman. Thanks for having me back.
So we have impeachment 2.0 underway. It would appear to be more an exercise in theater than actual impeachment. So what has happened so far, Scott?
Yeah, I think you're right. This is political theater, and it's not an actual trial, right? This impeachment trial that's going on in the Senate, there's been a lot of questions about whether the president was afforded due process and any constitutional protections to defend himself. But the bottom line is, what we saw this week was the Trump defense team and then the House impeachment managers making their case to the American people on what exactly happened on January 6th and whether or not President Trump should be held responsible for any action or inaction that he took on that day.
A number of Republican senators, I believe five, Scott, joined with Democrats to make the decision that this was, in fact, a constitutional exercise, although there's still a lot of question about that. What sort of impact do you see this all having on the political futures of those senators?
Initially, they held a constitutional point of order a couple of weeks ago that Rand Paul raised as they were doing the organizing resolution for the impeachment trial. And five senators voted with the Democrats. It was 55-45 to say that the proceeding was constitutional. Then you saw the House managers make their initial case this week, and they held another vote, and they actually flipped one of the Republicans. They flipped Senator Bill Cassidy from Louisiana. So that vote was 56-44. And I think what you're seeing here is a pretty strong case being built by the House managers that there should be a proceeding to an impeachment trial, and they moved forward. Now the question is, if those 44 Republicans voted to say that it's unconstitutional, are they going to be persuaded in the course of the proceedings to actually vote to convict the president?
Let's shift gears here and talk economics for a minute. There's an investment device, a monetary device, or whatever you want to call it, called Bitcoin, which has sort of operated on the fringes for a number of years, but now appears to be going more mainstream. Before we talk about a major development on the Bitcoin front this past week, Scott, tell us what it is and how it works.
Bitcoin is a digital currency that was created back in 2009, and the idea here is that people created a technology that promises lower transaction fees than traditional online payment mechanisms. And unlike government-issued currency, it's operated by a decentralized authority. So anybody can really invest in Bitcoin. There's a bunch of different trading platforms where you can buy Bitcoin. You don't have to buy a whole coin. It's not like a physical coin that's going to be mailed to you, right? So you can buy a very, very small percentage. You could put $50 every paycheck into Bitcoin and grow that as an asset in your investment portfolio. And so a lot of people have been doing that. And the people that invested back in 2009 and 2010, many of them are now Bitcoin billionaires because Bitcoin's price has soared in 2021 and obviously over the last couple of years. Right now it's trading around $48,000 per Bitcoin. And what that means is really that a lot of companies that are major drivers of the U.S. economy are reevaluating their own investment portfolios and how they look at digital currencies and cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin.
And this past week, Tesla became, I guess you would have to say, a major player on the Bitcoin field. What has Tesla done?
Elon Musk is certainly a trendsetter on a lot of the digital currencies. He's sort of got this joke out there with doggy coins. But Tesla announced in an SEC filing this week that it had bought $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin and that it would start accepting Bitcoin as a payment method for its products. So Elon Musk is actually being credited for raising the price of cryptocurrencies through a lot of his social media following. And, you know, he can tweet out about cryptocurrencies and get a couple hundred thousand people to respond to that within minutes. Certainly, Tesla is not the only company that's doing investments in Bitcoin. There's a website that folks can check out, bitcointreasuries.org, and it says which publicly held companies are accumulating assets in Bitcoin. And, you know, you're seeing some major companies like Square and Coin Citadel. You're seeing, obviously, Tesla, some very, very small holdings. Some folks have maybe today's value would be a few billion dollars. Some might have a couple million dollars in Bitcoin. Nonetheless, I think what we're seeing with Tesla taking it and then watching how the Bitcoin market reacted, it's a real question for these S&P 500 companies, Fortune 500 companies. When are they going to make the switch to investing on behalf of their shareholders into Bitcoin and digital currencies in order to capitalize on what's happening in terms of a revolution with investments.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, tell us a little bit about the club.
Sure thing. So the club is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We're focused on economic freedom and liberty. And if your listeners want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. And our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
President Joe Biden and U.S. Senator Mitt Romney are looking to reshape tax policy to put more money into the hands of those raising children. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine examines the proposals.
If you have kids at home, a major overhaul of how the federal government handles welfare for families could mean that you'd be getting checks worth $3,000 annually for each and every one of those little youngsters. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, we're taking a look at a proposed major overhaul of how the federal government handles welfare payments for families, a proposal, a bipartisan proposal, we should note, that is coming from Senator Mitt Romney of Utah and President Joe Biden. Now, the two plans that Senator Romney and President Biden are offering differ in some of their specifics, but both of them are aiming to subsidize the costs of raising children in a more direct way than the federal government currently does. And I think that's something of a noble goal, certainly a thing that would boost the economic prospects of poorer parents who may not be able to access the full value of the tax credit benefits that are currently built into the federal government's system of subsidizing families. But with the country more than $27 trillion in debt, I think it's also important to ask how these two plans would be paid for. We're going to look at all of that. But first, let's dig a little bit into the specifics of what Biden and Romney are saying the federal government should do. Biden's proposal that's currently being wrapped into this $1.9 trillion relief bill that the House of Representatives is drawing up, Biden's plan would send parents an annual total of $3,600 per child under age 6 and $3,000 every year for children aged between 6 and 17. Those payments would begin to phase out for single parents who earn more than $75,000 annually and for couples who earn more than $150,000 annually. And although this is actually being pitched as just a one-year program, it's likely to become permanent if it gets passed. Romney's plan, on the other hand, offers slightly larger benefits that would extend to a much more expansive set of parents, but it would be fully paid for by abolishing other welfare programs that Biden's plan would keep in place. Romney is suggesting that the federal government pay parents an annual total of $4,200 for every child under the age of 6 and $3,000, that's the same amount as Biden's proposal, for children aged 6 to 17. Those payments, though, would go to most parents. The phase-out wouldn't begin until you hit the income level of $400,000 for a couple in a single year or $200,000 for an individual. The bottom line to all of this is that if you're a parent and you qualify for the full payments during all 17 years that your child is eligible, then you would receive a total of $57,000 over those 17 years under Biden's plan and $62,000 under Romney's plan. Now, as with any expansion of the federal welfare state, I think the first question that has to be asked is how much will all of this cost and who will ultimately pay for it? Romney's plan is estimated to cost about $254 billion annually. But again, the senator says that those costs are fully offset because he's also proposing a series of changes to existing welfare programs. The child allowance would replace the existing child tax credit program and require a significant overhaul of the existing earned income tax credit, which offsets taxes for low-income families. Romney is also proposing to permanently abolish the state and local tax deduction, which exists mostly as a benefit for upper-income residents of states with high taxes. And he would also eliminate the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. That's the thing that we most often think of when we think of the word welfare. It's a joint federal-state program that provides direct cash assistance to poor families. All of that would go away, and instead that funding would be rolled into this new child allowance that Romney is proposing. Now, Biden, on the other hand, is not proposing any cuts to the existing welfare system, but his child allowance plan would cost an estimated $120 billion annually. Of course, the benefits there are less generous than Romney's. That's why the cost is lower. But the entire amount of Biden's plan would just be put on the national credit card. We'd just pile it on top of all the rest of the debt that we've already got there. So on that front, I think it's pretty clear that Romney's plan is clearly the better one of these two, although his promise that the whole thing is revenue neutral really needs to be scrutinized by some independent groups like the Congressional Budget Office before we can really agree that it works. But as long as the benefits are offset with cuts to other programs, then a shift to this sort of child allowance system probably makes some degree of sense. It could provide larger, more predictable benefits to needy families without adding to the national debt, and that really ought to be the goal here. If Democrats are unwilling to agree to the offsets that Romney has proposed, then he should dial back the proposed benefits as well. And honestly, that wouldn't be a terrible idea because there's really no need to subsidize families that are earning up to $400,000 annually to begin with. This would also be a significant shift in terms of the overall goals of federal welfare policy, which since the 1990s, when the last major welfare reforms were passed, have been largely predicated on creating incentives to work. That's been basically the defining feature of conservative welfare reforms for decades, and moving away from it is likely to create some Republican objections. In fact, already Senator Marco Rubio and Senator Mike Lee have called out Romney's proposal for, quote, undercutting the responsibility of parents to work to provide for their families. At the end of the day, of course, the federal government really shouldn't be in the business of incentivizing people to have children, regardless of whether it's doing that by doling out benefits through the tax code or the welfare system. At their core, both the Biden plan and the Romney plan are a form of social engineering that rewards people for choosing to reproduce, even if, and maybe especially if, they can't afford to raise children on their own. And it would be better if the federal government just didn't engage in this type of behavior or policy at all. But if the government is going to do these things, and it certainly seems like it has an interest in doing that, then there's a responsibility that the federal government has to taxpayers, both current and future, to do so in a fiscally responsible, efficient way. If Romney and Biden can streamline the tangled family safety net programs that currently exist without adding to the national debt and without creating too many perverse incentives, then I think it's fair to give them a chance to do it. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of all these sorts of detailed policy discussions that are happening under the new administration at Reason.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter as well, and you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Donald Trump impeachment 2.0 is an unconstitutional exercise in political theater. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The lack of logic and clear thinking from the media covering Donald Trump's second impeachment trial is actually frightening. Of course, we all knew that these proceedings would be political theater, not the serious process laid out in the Constitution. But where is there a single nationally respected voice doing the simple step-by-step analysis of how the process now playing out before the American people is a charade, a corruption of the Constitution? Mark Levin has a grasp of the illogic of the anti-Trump leadership in the House manager's arguments, but the media covering the impeachment trial are so constitutionally illiterate that they can't see it. Mark Levin says that there cannot be an impeachment trial on a private citizen. Why is that? Because the impeachment process has only one verdict if the accused is found guilty, removal from public office. If one holds no public office, one cannot be subject to the verdict of removal from office. The first step is to determine if a high crime or misdemeanor has been committed. I think there's genius in the fact that the terms high crimes and misdemeanors is undefined in the Constitution, while others decry the lack of definition and consider it a flaw in the Constitution. Does incitement to insurrection meet the test? What is the test? How is it applied? I suggest that if the House of Representatives conducts a vote in which an officeholder is accused of anything, whether a well-defined act of lawlessness like bribery or murder, or something less defined like obstruction of justice or incitement to insurrection, and if a majority of the House votes to support the impeachment vote, then, by definition, in that particular case, the conduct in question is indeed an impeachable offense. President Gerald Ford, commenting on the ultimately unsuccessful effort to impeach Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas in 1970, said, quote, "An impeachable offense is whatever a majority of the House of Representatives considers it to be at any given moment in history," close quote. The House voted 232 to 197 to impeach Donald Trump, the then president, for incitement to insurrection. That was, therefore, perfectly constitutional. The second step is a Senate trial. When that old fox Mitch McConnell, master of the rules and procedures of the United States Senate, delayed the process so that the Senate trial could not begin before President Trump had left office, he rendered the Senate trial moot. The Senate's own website, senate.gov, has this helpful and clear statement. The penalty for an impeached official upon conviction is removal from office. Therefore, someone who does not hold public office cannot be found guilty of an impeachable offense because the only verdict would not apply. There has been a lot of sophistry around the question of a January exception, meaning that if the Senate decides not to convict President Donald Trump, they are allowing one, which means that any president can do anything in their last days of office without consequence. Jeremy Stahl, writing for Slate, said this argument, put forth by House Manager Jamie Raskin, was, quote, "tactically brilliant," close quote. He posited that the jurisdictional claim that a non-office holder cannot be convicted of an impeachable offense, quote, "would open impeachment to a secret January exception never intended by the founders, which would be an invitation to our founders' worst nightmare," close quote. Mr. Raskin's statement may be tactically brilliant in the current political environment, but it is constitutionally invalid. A term of office has a beginning and an end. For the entire time in between, an officeholder is potentially impeachable, down to the very last day. But after that last day, he is no longer removable. The January exception is therefore a completely specious smokescreen designed to confuse people and take their eyes off the plain meaning of the Constitution. Unfortunately, the Senate trial of Donald Trump is being pursued for one reason and one reason only: to embarrass him and all Republicans by inference. And it's working. If you want to call anything the founder's worst nightmare, it's that. A Senate trial on an impeachable offense should be the single most somber proceeding in our republic. But what senator today would willingly give up a few moments in the national media spotlight for the sake of fidelity to the Constitution? Not many, I'm sorry to say, certainly not a majority. So the circus will go on to the detriment of our ideals and with the disturbingly eager support of our mainstream media. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliates, WOND-AM, WBSS-AM, WMGM-FM, and WTKU-FM, all in Lynnwood, New Jersey. Welcome to our new listeners in the Garden State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.